And thanks also for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to talk in PI. It's the first time I've been here. It's a wonderful place. So here's the outline of my talk. So I want to tell you about some theoretical work that we've been doing discussing the behavior of magnetic configurations on a pyrochlore lattice structure. So I want to tell you a little bit about this Coulomb gas picture of spin ice, and I should stress that it's not really a spin ice talk. It's a development of theoretical ideas around spin ice. And I want to tell you about great gauge fields, this idea of monopole crystallization, and then at the end try and make some confrontation with experiments. Although you decide whether I succeed or not. Okay, so this is worked in collaboration with people from University College in London, so students Marion Brooks Bartlett and Adam Harman Clark, and Simon Banks, who has a position there, and Ludovic Jobert, who is now at the University of Okinawa in Japan. Okay, oops, I lost a picture. Oh no, I don't know if there are many pictures that are going to be lost.
Just turn your computer out.
I've lost it here too, actually.
It got fractionalized.
It got fractionalized. Well, we'll see how many goes down. It was a, it was a tetrahedron with two in, two out. Okay, so there are many people here with whom I don't need that. So this is a picture of magnetic moments in these spin ice materials that were invented by Mark Harris and Stephen Bramwell over 20 years ago, nearly 20 years ago, and. So the simplest way to think of them is having icing-like degrees of freedom on this corner-sharing pyrochlore lattice. And lowest energy configuration for magnetic moments on each tetrahedron would be to have two spins pointing out of the tetrahedron and two spins pointing into the tetrahedron. And the pyrochlore lattice has this corner-sharing set of tetrahedra. And the center of the tetrahedra, form a diamond lattice. Okay, so so here's the picture. I've made it. So a very good tried and trusted starting point for the description of spin ice materials is this dipolar spin ice model. So these systems of holmium, these materials with holmium and dysprosium ions have large magnetic moments, nearly 10 Bohr magnetons, and they're very strongly icing-like. And so you have a magnetic exchange interaction and a dipolar interaction for these materials. They're both in the 1 Kelvin range. And crystal fields that force the magnetic degrees of freedom to be icing-like along these lines that join the centers of the tetrahedra, and these are something like 100 Kelvin or more, and so in the 10 Kelvin range, these really behave like icing-like degrees of freedom. And in this so-called two-in, two-out ground state configuration for a single tetrahedron, if you make a mapping all over the lattice of the two-in, two-out structure, you find for this dipolar spin ice model already a remarkable property that the long-range part of this dipolar interaction is almost completely screened, even though you might choose a random configuration of magnetic moments. So you have a random configuration of magnetic moments, you have a long-range interacting Hamiltonian, but the long-range part is essentially screened and cancels out. You can see why that is. If you make a further abstraction to the so-called dumbbell model or needle model of spin ice, and this was made by Castelnuovo, Mosner and Sondi a few years ago in this well-known paper. And this is, that is then to take your model with point dipoles and extend the point dipoles as needles or dumbbells, so you have a little magnetic north pole and a little magnetic south pole at the end of the dumbbells, And the dumbbells meet at the centers of the tetrahedra. So if you can, if you do that, then perhaps you can see already that a two-in, two-out configuration will have at the center of each tetrahedron two red balls and two blue balls, so two north poles and two south poles. And so you'll have magnetic neutrality. And you can see then that there's no room for any effects of long-range interactions. You get perfect screening of the magnetic interactions in this case. And in this case then, there's a huge degeneracy of possible lowest energy configurations, the so-called poling states. And the poling states, these poling states appeared for the first time in the first half of the 20th century as the lowest energy configurations for protons in water ice, hence the name spin ice. So here you've got, if you place the oxygen ion at the center of each tetrahedron, then you have two protons that make up a water molecule, and the proton being here or here can be mapped onto the spin being in this direction or this direction. You can see that the magnetic moments and the protons share the same phase space. And there were famous experiments in the 1930s to measure the residual entropy of the proton degrees of freedom. And so spin ice, soon after its discovery, there were experiments by Ramirez and collaborators that attempted to measure this Pauling entropy. So this is the specific heat as a function of temperature, no magnetic phase transition. And you have icing spins. So if you integrate under this curve at high temperature, you might expect to find an entropy of R log 2. But actually, the entropy is less. And it's less by this so-called Pauling entropy to a very good approximation. And all that would be exact if you were working within the confines of this dumbbell model of spin ice. Okay, so the dumbbell model actually has corrections to it, both if you go from the dumbbell back to dipolar spin ice, and perhaps more importantly, if you go from the dumbbell model to real materials, because this this screening is not quite perfect in the dipolar spin ice model. If you do a clever Monte Carlo simulation, you find that at low temperature, this excess entropy reappears as a phase transition and you get an ordered phase. And recently, this work by Pomeransky and collaborators from here in Waterloo showed that in this spin ice material, dysprosium titanate, then you get deviations from this picture of true spin ice behavior at real materials. So it's a theoretician's picture, and there are very interesting corrections to this theoretician's picture. But for the moment, I want to discuss more this theoretical picture of dumbbell model and its excitation. Okay, so the excitations are interesting because these low energy configurations of having two spins in and two spins out, you can look at this as like a lattice version of a local divergence-free constraint. Every tetrahedron must have the divergence of M equal to zero, so as many magnetic moment field lines going in as coming out. And so you have this kind of paramagnetic behavior with disordered configurations, but everywhere you've got this divergence-free condition that satisfies. And so if you you can make excitations by flipping spins and leaving this manifold of states with two spins in and two spins out. So here's a piece of the pyroclore lattice with everywhere each tetrahedron with two spins in and two spins out. So I flip a spin, I flip this spin, and this gives me one tetrahedron with three in and one out, and one with three out and one in. So this gives you a pair of defects. If I now flip the second spin here, I can re-establish the ice rules on this tetrahedron, and I've moved the blue defect from this point to this point. So you can see these defects have a kind of topological nature. I'm not going to be able to re-establish the ice rules until I move the blue defect throughout the system until it rejoins a red defect, and it rejoins and recreates the two in, two out scenario. So they have a topological aspect, and they're deconfined. They can move around the system as they wish. And so that's one aspect of rather interesting properties of this Dumbell model, the topological nature of the defects and their deconfinement. The second interesting point is that because here you've really got dipole interactions with the dipole apart that cancels out, when you create these defects and you move them apart, the real magnetic interactions raise their heads again. And as you move them apart, you get a Coulomb interaction between the topological defects. And this is a curve from Castelnuovo, Mosner, and Sondi's paper showing the Coulomb nature of these defects. They created a pair of defects and moved them apart, progressively apart, and showed indeed that their interaction scales like a Coulomb law. And the magnetic charge is defined as two times, this is the magnetic moment, M, two times the magnetic moment, divided by a distance A, which is the distance between diamond lattice sites. And you can see that from a magnetic point of view. So here's, you've got a magnetic moment M, and you flip the spin. And so you've got delta M, which is equal to 2M. So you've changed the magnetic moment of the system by 2M. By moving a blue, by inversing the position of a blue sphere and a red sphere. And so I've moved this charge through a distance A, and this corresponds then to a magnetic charge of 2m over A. Okay, and so because of these, the magnetic charge on these defects, Castelnuovo, Mosner, and Sondi gave them the name of magnetic monopoles. So that's a very racy title that gained lots of publicity and interest. Of course, these objects, they're quasi-particles in the solid-state host. So they don't mean that Maxwell's equations need to be rewritten. The divergence of the B field is everywhere zero. But there's a divergence of this magnetic moment field, which means there's a divergence of the magnetic field H. And so these things are singularities in the magnetic intensity H rather than the B field. Okay, so they have a Coulomb interaction. Their number is not conserved. And so I would like to present this idea of the excitations above the ground state in this model of spin ice as being Coulomb gas of quasi-particles in the grand canonical ensemble. And a small revision of the grand canonical ensemble. So in this ensemble, then, I'm going to fix the temperature and the chemical potential. So I'm a theoretician, and I can choose the value of the temperature and the chemical potential that I want. And so then I'm going to do statistical mechanics, either analytically or numerically. So I've got a relevant energy that you might call the Landau energy, that is the Coulomb energy of the microstate minus mu times the number of particles in the microstate. And this is valid for any number of particles in the system. The number of particles can vary, including a microstate where there are no particles. If I start off with a vacuum, I create two, and I move the particles, the two particles, I separate them by infinity. You can see then that this U tilde will change by a distance minus 2 mu. And so you can see that the chemical potential then, I can define the chemical potential as the energy required to create a pair of particles and separate them by infinite distance. Okay, so as I say, I'm a theoretician, and in the rest of the seminar, I'm going to choose whatever value of chemical potential I wish to make the physics interesting. I might just take an aside and say how you would estimate the value of this chemical potential for spin ice-like materials. So this is how we attempted to do it for dysprosium titanate, one of the spin ice materials. So what we did was we simulated the dipolar spin ice model using parameters estimated here in Waterloo that fit the physics of dysprosium titanate. So for each numerical step, for instance, if you have a numerical step that creates a nearest neighbor pair of defect in the dipolar spin ice model, this will give you an energy delta U defect. And as well as the dipolar spin ice, we had a slave Coulomb gas. So the dipolar spin ice is driving, it creates defects, the defects move. And behind it, we have a Coulomb gas that's recording all the energy moves associated with the dynamics of the dipolar spin ice. So then from what I've just told you, if you've got this defect energy of creating a pair of particles, this is equal to the change in Coulomb energy in the Coulomb gas minus the chemical potential. So you can measure this and you can measure this, and so you can calculate this. And this is what you find in this dipolar spin ice for dysprosium titanate values. This black curve as a function of temperature is the measured chemical potential. You can see that it's essentially constant and comes out to be a few Kelvin, minus 4.46 Kelvin for each particle, minus 8.9 Kelvin for a pair of particles. So this really just shows that the Coulomb gas model, the dumbbell model, is really a reasonable approximation for describing at least the statics of this dipolar spin ice model. For real spin ice materials, that's another question. But for dipolar spin ice, I think this shows that it's clear. Okay, so now I want to go back and discuss a little bit the magnetic moments within the language of a lattice gauge field. Okay, so if you accept this picture of a Coulomb gas of quasi-particles, then the Coulomb gas everywhere must obey this Gauss's law here, okay? And so I want to discuss this Gauss's law within the confines of a lattice. And from a theoretical point of view, it's often very tempting just to go straight to a continuum description. But here, I think it's very constructive to remain on the lattice and to look at the behavior of this lattice fields that appear. So here's the integral form of Gauss's law. So you take a volume and the integral of this magnetic moment field, so this is density of magnetic moment, integrated over the surface gives you the charge with a minus sign, gives you a charge inside the surface. And so now if I go from here to this dumbbell model, now the magnetic moments are confined to this infinitesimally thin needles. So I want to define a lattice gauge field, which is Mij, that lives on this needle between I and J, which would be the magnetic moment density, the dot product of the magnetic moment density, with the area of the cross-sectional area of this needle. So this is a mathematical construct. So this is taken to be infinitesimally thin. The whole of the magnetic moment field is constrained to this needle. And so I can define an Mij, which because of this dot product would be minus Mji, that's just plus or minus M over A, where M is the size of the magnetic moment and A is the distance between diamond lattice sites. So now Gauss's law, which is the integral over this tetrahedral volume, would just be a discrete sum over J Mij, which is equal to minus Qi. And here I take a defect state with three magnetic moments that come into the tetrahedron and one that comes out. So in units of M over A, I could write this defect as minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1. And so this gives me, from this law here, so the sum of three minuses and a plus with the minus sign, it gives me 2M over A, the value given by Castelnuovo, proposed by Castelnuovo, Mosner, and Sondi. Okay, so this is where I started to think about this problem, because I want to discuss Gauss's law, and I have a charge at the center of this tetrahedron. And in my mind, thinking back to my undergraduate electrostatics course, what I expected was to have a charge in the center of this tetrahedron and some symmetric array of field lines coming out of it, right? But what I've got is this three in, one out. It doesn't look anything like this, right? And so what I decided to do was to try and make it like this. And this is the main part of this seminar. If I can sell you this slide, I've sold you the whole seminar, right? So what I propose you can do is you can write minus one, minus one, minus one, one as minus a half, minus a half, minus a half, minus a half, plus minus a half, minus a half, minus a half, plus three halves, right? So I've taken this three in, one out object and I've split it into two parts. One part looks like that, this part. It satisfies the local lattice Gauss's law. And the second part gives you a second gauge field that's clearly divergence free. It has three bits coming in, three small bits coming in, and one big bit that's three times as big coming out. Okay? So this is just a lattice example of what we all learn in in undergraduate electromagnetism, that if you want to solve Gauss's law, then you can write a simplest solution is have the magnetic moment field that's the gradient of the scalar potential. But you can also write this magnetic moment field as the gradient of a scalar potential plus a second part that is divergence free. Okay, it's a field that has the rotation the curl of a vector Q, right? So I split this up into two parts, an M monopolar and an M rotational. And that's the magnetic moment fractionalization in this seminar. Okay, and I really got this idea from reading this. If you're interested in this kind of thing, I definitely think you should read this paper by Tony Maggs and Vincent Rossetto. They were discussing something quite different, numerical algorithms efficient numerical algorithms for Coulombic systems, but they used exactly this fact that if you have a distribution of charges, you can write the electric field as the gradient of a scalar potential and a vector part that's divergence free. And in electrostatics, what you learn about in an undergraduate course in electrostatics is the lowest energy case is that the rotational part is zero. But actually, if you have a non-zero rotational part, this is the bit that couples to the magnetic field, and this is the bit that gives you electrodynamics, classical electrodynamics. And some of these ideas are also discussed in this paper by Steve Bramall within a magnetic context. Okay, and so there's been much work written about these internal divergence-free fields in spin ice. So I'll just discuss quickly through these points on these internal divergence-free gauge fields, because they've been very important in spin ice. Okay, so the monopole vacuum, that is the two in, two out states, has divergence-free gauge fields only. Okay, so you only have configurations where you have two in, two out. So none of this, only this. And so this gives you neutron scattering behavior that's characteristic of this divergence-free field, so-called pinch points, measured particularly by Tom Fennell and collaborators. It means that despite the fact that I've described this ground state as a monopole vacuum, it's a very strange kind of vacuum because it has very large internal fields. A further point that we've already seen is if you only have single charges, the single charges distort this divergence-free field, but they don't kill it. So if you only have a soup of single charges, you're still going to have a very strong background field, a divergence-free gauge field that'll be more or less disordered, but it'll be there. And that's very important and may be related to the fact that these pinch points in spin ice materials actually live up to very high temperatures, surprisingly high temperatures. I can come back to this point later. Okay, so now I tried to present to you this idea of a monopole vacuum and a grand canonical Coulomb gas with a chemical potential that I'm going to fix, and also this auxiliary field that's not related to the monopole charge, that's divergence free. And for experimental materials, dysprosium and holmium titanate, the ground state is a monopole vacuum, but this could change by changing the chemical potential, right? For instance, if I was to make the size, the amplitude of the chemical potential small enough, so the Coulomb energy gain of having a crystal of these objects with north poles on one set of tetrahedra and south poles on another set of tetrahedra, if that outweighed the energy cost of the chemical potential of introducing them, then the ground state, instead of being a vacuum, would be a monopole crystal. And this crystalline structure, the Coulomb energy is of this form. It would be the number of diamond lattice sites times UA over 2, where UA is the Coulomb energy for nearest neighbor charged particles, times alpha, which is the Madelung constant for the diamond lattice that you can look up on Wikipedia. Okay, so if you take the length, if you take the charge and length scale of DTO, it would mean that this chemical potential would have to be greater than minus 2.5 Kelvin. And if you did that, instead of having a monopole vacuum, you'd break this Z2 symmetry, and you'd have a crystal of monopoles with the blue south pole sat on one kind of diamond lattice site and the red north pole sat on the other kind of diamond lattice site. And then dressing all this, you'd have this auxiliary divergence-free gauge field. Okay, so we've been looking at this kind of problem for several years with Monte Carlo simulations. And so we're essentially doing numerical simulations of a Coulomb gas on a diamond lattice site. So you've got moves that can either be creation of a pair, I've explained to you how to do it, or the change in Coulomb energy when you move a set of pair from one position to another. Long-range interactions are taken into account using the Ewald summation. And so you have hopping of these particles throughout the lattice. But also, as well as the particle moves, there's also these hidden degrees of freedom, which are the direction of the arrows, the magnetic moments, the directions of the needles. So when a particle moves, it changes the direction of this needle. So the red particles will move in the direction of the arrows, and when they move, they'll change the direction. And the blue particles will move against the arrows, and when they move, they'll change the direction. So all the time, there's an upkeep of these arrows, and this gives you this fluctuating background gauge field. Okay, so for different values of chemical potential below this threshold, this is the density of monopoles, this is what you get. So for values above my threshold, then the monopole density comes down as the temperature reduces, but then you get to some temperature and buff, you get a huge rise in the monopole concentration. And here it looks kind of second order like, and then as you get nearer the phase boundary, it looks like it becomes first order. And as you go above it, then instead of going to a chart, going to a full high concentration of magnetic monopoles, you go back to the vacuum, you go back to the ground state of spin ice. And I think this is not quite my theoretical limit. I think there's some finite size rounding there because of the finite size system. Okay, and I can also define an order parameter for this broken symmetry crystallization. So the order parameter would be sum over sites I, qi, delta I. So qi is the charge on site I, so it can either be 0, plus or minus 1. And delta I is plus or minus 1, depending on whether it's an A site or a B site. So when you go through this crystallization transition, then there's some finite value of the order parameter, and then it jumps, some small value of the order parameter, and then it jumps towards 1, indicating that we do have this monopole crystal structure. And for anybody who's interested in in phase transitions in critical phenomena, this is a whole another part of this project that I won't have time to discuss today, but there's a second order phase transition that near the boundary becomes first order via a tricritical point, and the phase diagram, this is the density as a function of chemical potential fixed low temperature, and this is very similar to the Bloom-Capell model for spin one icing systems, if anybody's interested here. There's a phase transition here where the density is essentially constant. So this is like an icing, three-dimensional icing phase transition. Here there's a huge jump in the density, and there's a tricritical point around here, and the phase boundary ends around here. And this is essentially the same as standard Coulomb gas physics. You might like to read these papers from Fisher and collaborators from the 1990s when they discussed the physics of this lattice Coulomb gas. The only difference being here is that there are a certain number of constraints because of the arrows that change direction when the particles move, but they don't make any difference to the general thermodynamics of the phase diagram. Okay, so what about the magnetic degrees of freedom? I've offered you this fractionalization of the magnetic moments. This part suggests that there should be magnetic Bragg peaks, because it's suggesting that I've taken the magnetic moments and I've broken them into two parts. One part of the magnetic moment fields looks like, on the tetrahedron, all spins are pointing in or all spins are pointing out, all in on the A sites and all out on the B sites. And if you look at the full simulated neutron scattering from a configuration below the phase transition, this is what you get, 220 Bragg peaks that are characteristic of all-in, all-out magnetic order, and the intensity of this all-in, all-out magnetic order is exactly what you'd expect for spins of length 1 divided by a factor of 4, and that's consistent with the fact that you've got factor of a half. Okay, so and when, if you subtract this coherent scattering, you can make a calculation and subtract the coherent scattering, what's left is this rather familiar pattern of diffuse scattering that is characteristic of a Coulomb phase. So this part of the magnetic moment field is hived off, and it looks like it's behaving in some correlated disordered way, giving you scattering of a new Coulomb phase. So essentially what happens then is that if you form the monopole crystal, then each tetrahedral unit has either three in, one out, or three out, one in associated with it. It has one odd spin. And if you make the monopole crystal, then pairs of AB sites share the odd spin. And actually what you can do is you can recognize that if you place a hypothetical hardcore dimer in the position of the odd spin, then the spin configuration of this part of the magnetic moment field maps onto the phase space of hardcore dimers on a diamond lattice. I should draw your attention to this paper by Hughes and collaborators that showed that if you have a diamond lattice, a configuration of dimers on a bipartite lattice, you can extract from this dimer configuration a divergence-free field that characterizes the non-trivial correlations that you get in this dimer, for these dimer configurations. And here it is in more detail. So classical dimer coverings have extensive entropy but non-trivial correlations. If you constrain to one dimer per site, you can define an emergent divergence-free field that is of strength 1 along the dimer and minus 1 over z minus 1, where z is the number of nearest neighbors between the dimers, and this gives you a divergence-free condition for this effective emergent gauge field. And now we have a mapping in the opposite direction. We have exactly this property for this part of the field. For the diamond lattice, we have three small bits going in and one big bit going out, such that the divergence is everywhere zero. So it's exactly this mapping for a diamond lattice. And so maybe it's one another mapping that I can illustrate is there's a well-known mapping between the spin ice 2-in-2-out configurations and the 2-up, 2-down configurations of an icing antiferromagnet. This is Anderson's model of icing of an icing antiferromagnet. And so this monopole crystal, it maps onto an icing antiferromagnet. And the crystalline phase, the broken symmetry, the Z2 broken symmetry of the crystalline phase, corresponds to breaking the symmetry between three spins down and one up, or three spins up and one down. And so if you tile the diamond lattice with on each tetrahedron three down and one up, and you place a dimer on the bond with the up spin, then you get the same mapping to dimer configuration. And I did think until this morning that this was an example work from Californian group on quantum spin liquids. They have a rather exotic quantum spin liquid called the Coulomb ferromagnetic Coulomb phase. And I believe that this was a classical example of a ferromagnetic Coulomb phase, because in these effective degrees of freedom, there's a ferromagnetic moment. That may or may not be true, but it's a different kind of Coulomb phase with a broken symmetry in these degrees of magnetic moment in these degrees of freedom. Okay, so I'd like just to say something about the dynamics of these the spins. If you go to some temperature, here's the order parameter and the density as a function of temperature. If you go to some temperature just below the phase transition, where the monopole density is extremely high, and you look at dynamics in the system, so even simple Metropolis local spin dynamics, you can define a charge-charge correlation function for the charges on site I, or you can define a spin-spin correlation function. And so the charge-charge is the red and the spin-spin is the blue. So what this is telling you is, despite the fact that you've all got almost perfect charge correlation, so almost perfect order of charges on the monopole charges on the lattice, the spins are continuing to move, continuing to fluctuate, and they remain ergodic. This is rather modest, unsophisticated Metropolis simulation, and the spin correlation function in some measurable time decays quite rapidly to this asymptotic limit. And the asymptotic limit of a quarter here is it's because on the tetrahedron you've got three like spins and one different spin, so there's the one quarter possibility of having a configuration, one particular kind of configuration. And this is for a slightly lower temperature. There's slower dynamics, but still it's clearly decaying with time. And the dynamics actually, although it's completely classical, they kind of mimic dimer plaquette moves of hardcore dimer models. So here's a typical kind of dynamics that you might get. So here in a square lattice configuration is a typical kind of monopole configuration. So you have broken symmetry for the monopoles, and you've got three in and one out. So you place the dimer on the odd spin here. Now you might make some Monte Carlo flips, moves that flip these needles, these two needles. This is re-established, these are the ice rules, two in, two out here. And then as a second set of moves, you flip this needle and this needle. This re-establishes the crystal, but it moves the dimer to here. So you've got a kind of a dimer plaquette dynamics. What about other magnetic signals of this transition? So it's a magnetic phase transition with antiferromagnetic Bragg peaks, and you've essentially got Ising degrees of freedom. So you might expect to have a cusp in the susceptibility, for instance. So here's the susceptibility. And the phase transition is here, and this is a bulk susceptibility as a function of temperature in the second order part of the phase diagram. And in this susceptibility, there's absolutely no signal of this magnetic phase transition. So you've got these background fluctuations that continue to be present despite the fact that you've got long range order. Here, as you get very close to the phase boundary in this first order part, there's a very small kink, but essentially very small signal. So unless you can see these weak Bragg peaks, it's essentially pretty transparent to magnetic probes. And quickly, I'll just say a word about a similar but slightly different system, charge ordering in Kagame ice. So there's a very analogous problem studied quite a lot in the field of artificial spin ice, where you study magnetic moments confined to the nodes of a Kagame lattice in two dimensions. And there's a constrained phase that has finite entropy, where on each triangle you'd have two spins pointing out in this case, and one in everywhere, two out and one in. So now if you make the same dumbbell picture for these spins, you find that on each triangle there are two red spots and one blue, or two blue spots and one red. This kind of zinc blend or sodium chloride magnetic charge ordering in this system. And there were very nice series of papers by Chernyshev and collaborators that showed that in a dipolar system, you can have a hierarchy of phase transitions and an intermediate phase where you find yourself here in the constrained phase with finite entropy. And so finite entropy, but a charge-ordered system. And you can play exactly the same moment fractionalization game here, because you could take a triangle. With two in and one out, which I would write as minus one, minus one, one. And there's a charge at the center of it. And so I could split this up as minus a third, minus a third, minus a third. And that gives you a charge of one in units of m over a here, and that's correct. And this gives you a leftover part, minus two thirds, four thirds. And this is, again, an emergent divergence-free field that's split off from this charge-ordered part. And if you take a configuration from the dumbbell model and you scatter numerical neutrons off it, then you get a pinch point pattern that looks like this. You get pictures of the emergent divergence-free gauge field, but there are also Bragg peaks that appear. And the Bragg peaks are those of an all-in, all-out phase, and their intensity is exactly one-ninth of what you'd expect if you had a phase with all spins either in or out on the triangle. So you can play the same game. Okay, so that was a theoretical part, so I felt that I should try and make some encounter with experiment in the last 5 or 10 minutes of the seminar. So this is more difficult. So first of all, there are two subjects that one can discuss. First, one might like to discuss the behavior of spin ice in a field where actually this monopole crystal phase has already been seen in experiment. So there are a series of experiments, first ones, I believe, by a Japanese group, where you place a spin ice material in a 1-1-1 field. And as you increase the field for fixed temperature, then as you leave this spin ice regime, there's a first order phase transition from one magnetically ordered state to a second state with a higher magnetic moment. And as you increase the temperature, then this first order phase transition ends at a critical point. And this is essentially this monopole crystallization phase transition, because the magnetic moments, when you apply the magnetic field, if the magnetic moments were free, they'd want to move like electric charge in electric field. You'd want to have a magnetic moment current. But actually, because of the spin configurations as a constraint on how the particles can move, they can't move in the direction of the field. They're stuck in these planes. And so the magnetic field acts like a staggered chemical potential, giving a preference for north poles on B sites and south poles on A sites, for instance, as you apply it. So it's like the field breaks this Z2 symmetry. And so you get the remnant of this first order phase transition. And as you increase the field or the temperature, then this first order phase transition ends in a critical endpoint. Okay, so that's interesting. It's not quite the full story, however, because this magnetic field couples to both parts of this fractured magnetic moment field, both to the magnetic charges, but also to this emergent gauge field. And so one might like to ask the question whether or not one could observe evidence of this magnetic moment crystallization in a zero field scenario. And I have to preface this by saying it's somewhat more tenuous. But anyway, I'll make some comments. So this is a phase diagram for this dipolar spin ice model. And physically, you can change the chemical potential for this Coulomb gas by changing the value of this magnetic exchange parameter, because this changes the energy required to create a nearest neighbor pair of monopoles. So as you go in this direction, you're reducing the chemical potential and essentially doing what I suggested one would like to do to have the monopole crystal. And here at this point, the spin ice phase abruptly changes. You leave spin ice physics and you go to a magnetically ordered phase with all spins pointing in or all spins pointing out of each tetrahedron. Okay, and so this all-in, all-out phase is a kind of monopole crystallization, but it's not quite the same thing as I've been discussing, because this all-in, all-out configuration corresponds to crystallization of double monopoles, a charge of 2q, 4m over A. And so this would involve taking the entire magnetic moment field and using it to satisfy the charge ordering on an all-in, all-out configuration. It really is that magnetic equivalent of zinc blend with Zn2 plus S2 minus. Okay, so this is what happens in classical spin ice. As you increase the desire to have single monopoles, you also increase the desire to have double monopoles. And so the double monopole creation would kill any opportunity in classical physics of seeing this single monopole crystal with ambient background field. Okay, so classical modeling, it's completely out. But what you might think maybe would be that if you had a system with quantum fluctuations, then maybe the quantum fluctuations in this region could suppress the desire to have double charged objects and increase the desire to have single charged objects. So maybe in this region, you could imagine a scenario where quantum fluctuations could generate this single charge monopole crystallization. But it's far more complicated than that, because quantum fluctuations mean transverse spin fluctuations, and transverse spin fluctuations means distortion of the moment directions compared to the spin ice axes. And it's really a far more complicated problem than I can deal with in this simple phenomenology. However, one such material that does lie apparently fairly close to this spin ice phase boundary is this suggested quantum spin ice terbium titanate. this has a series of fascinating behaviors. It's believed to be close to lie, close to this spin ice boundary. There's no magnetic ordering down to zero temperature at ambient pressure. But if you put it in a pressure cell and increase the pressure, it undergoes a partial crystallization, a partial magnetic crystallization, a partial magnetic ordering. Okay, and it goes to an ordered structure that's much more complicated than my 3-in, 1-out, 3-out, 1-in configuration, something that looks like this. But this configuration, it does have a kind of 3-1 structure, and it does have this broken Z2 symmetry of A kind of tetrahedra and B kind of tetrahedra. So maybe my simple model is some derivative of this partial ordered structure observed here. And also another characteristic here that's similar to my model is that as well as the magnetic peaks, there's only partial ordering. So there's a background of highly fluctuating spins. There are also pinch points in terbium titanate. More recent experiments from Tom Fennell and collaborators show characteristic pinch points that are very different from those observed in spin ice materials, in hobium or dysprosium titanate, quite different from the ones that we observe, but still evidence of some emergent Coulomb, correlation. And there are also reports in this paper by Legler and collaborators of so-called incipient all-in, all-out ordering on adding a small 1-1-1 field. So maybe terbium titanate is indeed close to this phase boundary and just pushing it in one direction or in one direction, either by field or pressure, can take it towards a monopole crystal structure. And there's a second so-called quantum spin ice material that has a very mysterious, very weakly or non-magnetic phase transition from the magnetic degrees of freedom. In this quantum spin ice material at a few hundred millikelvin, there's a sharp feature in the specific heat, and in some experiments at least, essentially no evidence of magnetic ordering. So this remains unexplained. There are other possible explanations, a recent explanation of a quantum spin liquid's classical spin gas transition, but maybe our model could provide a further alternative. Or maybe not, but maybe our monopole crystal does show that there is in these frustrated materials a phase space necessary to have both phase transitions and highly fluctuating background of magnetic highly fluctuating magnetic background, and this is an omnipresent phenomenon in frustrated magnetism. So maybe this phenomenology could be interesting in generically understanding these phenomena further. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
So the Kagome ice case, general, it first charge order, then at a much lower temperature, it's spin orders.
Yes.
Right? So in your case, I think you mentioned that you also studied the dipolar interaction.
Well, this all these simulations are for a dumbbell model, right? So in this dumbbell model, there's no second phase transition. There's only this restricted part of the phase diagram. But the message here is actually that despite the fact that there is extensive entropy, because of this fractionalization, something that the community missed, is that it is partially ordered. And so if you scatter neutrons off a configuration that has finite entropy, then you do get these Bragg peaks. They do get the Bragg peaks, even in the intermediate phase.
Yeah, but for your particle model,
yes,
does it have a second phase?
Same thing. It's only for the dumbbell model.
I see.
Okay, so when we started this, there was some question: Should we be simulating dipolar spin-ice, or should we be simulating the dumbbell model? And I wanted to keep this, you know, like as abstract as possible to extract all the statistical mechanics out of this model before adding subtleties, which are the degeneracy breaking of the dipolar spin-ice model.
Other questions? So it sounds like this part about breaking the ice walls in two sectors, right? Mm. It's something which was missed, I think, in the Eastern Novo work in previous work, right? I mean, it's not. I don't think it's been spelled out. So.
Well, there is discussion of transverse part to. The magnetic moment, that you can split the magnetic moment in a longitudinal part and a transverse part. Mm-hmm. Okay. So people know that. It's in Steve Bramwell's paper, and I think if you talk to Roderick Mosner, he'd say that people know that. So maybe what's new is here the fact that when you stay on the lattice, you realize that, you know, there's a local constraint on the lattice, and that is that each magnetic moment, each needle has the same amplitude magnetic moment, and so this allows you to make this cutting here of this, and to produce these two fields. So this is the part I think that's new.
Another question?
I guess.
Yeah.
So what about defects in the material? Do you think that the in either the terbium titanate or in the DPO,
mm-hmm.
do you think that these are very important for the physics you're talking about?
I haven't prepared in detail this question, but I think one of the main points here is that if you believe this emergent gauge field stuff, okay, so now you take a magnetic charge. And the presence of a magnetic charge does not remove the emergent gauge field. Okay. So if you have disorder to the initial emergent gauge field, either by a monopole, by a defect, by a big moment, by a small moment, all those things will mean that you'll have to do a bit of this. Okay, but you're not going to get rid of all this emergent field. So that means then that, you know, in many situations, you could continue to see a fluctuating magnetic background despite the fact that something else is going on. And maybe I wasn't clear enough about that. So one of the messages here is that, you know, in this charge-ordered state, you know, if you did a clean neutron scattering experiment, you'd see Bragg peaks. But there's also a fluctuating background. Okay, so you know that that's a recurring theme in frustrated magnetism. I'm not saying that my model explains all that. I'm just saying, you know, in this model, the phase space is sufficient for that to occur. And now you can put dirt in it, and it won't go away. You know, you'll need a lot of dirt for it to go.
Okay, if there's no further questions, I thank Peter for a very interesting talk.